Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's also our podcast where we say one thing, but then end up having to do another thing due to extraneous circumstances or just some amount of forgetfulness or laziness on usually my part. But last episode, we did say we were going to talk about Architects of the West Kingdom, and we were not able to get together for a play session of that game, which we were both keen on doing to have just a little more of a grasp on that game, a little more play time to think about it, and also some time to explore one of the game's mechanics that we hadn't messed with yet. So anyways, instead of talking about Architects, which we will do in the near future, today we are talking about a different game. It is a game that I received recently. I think it was a present, Christmas present last year, and both of us have played the heck out of it. So Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Cartographers, designed by Jordi Aden and published in 2019 by Thunderstroke Games. And this nominated for a lot of things.
Excellent. This is, I think the full name is technically Cartographers, a Role Player Tale, because this is published by the same, or created by the same company that made Role Player, a game that we have discussed on this podcast previously. But this game is different than that game. We will go into it why. This is a pretty small, simple, quick to play game, but there's a lot of interesting things I think about it to discuss. So without further ado, let's get into a short description and then gameplay details and then strategy and then design about Cartographers, a Role Player Tale. So in Cartographers, players must plot the landscape, explore their respective kingdoms on an 11 by 11 grid across four seasons. Each turn of each season, a player draws the top card of the Explore deck and reveals it, and all players must draw the depicted shape in their kingdom and fill the shape in with the depicted terrain type. After each player has completed this task, players check the time values of the revealed Explore cards, and if they have totaled the season ends and players score points from two of the four point scoring cards. After four seasons have ended, the player with the most points wins. So there's probably a little bit of a confusion from that short description because there's a couple things we have to elaborate on. But the gist of it is that the game takes place over four rounds or seasons, as the game has it. And during a season, you draw a number of explore cards, which reveal shapes that you have to draw in your 11 by 11 grid of a kingdom and fill in with different symbols to determine what terrain type that area you've just drawn in is filled with. And then there are four cards that are selected at the beginning of the game that determine how you score points. And those cards generally care about the different kinds of terrain types you placed in your kingdom and how they are arranged next to one another or apart from one another. So let's get a little bit into the nitty gritty with how to play the game. And then that will lead into our strategy.
Sure.
Okay, so Matthew, why don't you start off with how the game is set up?
Right, so at the start of the game, you shuffle all of the, shape cards. I don't remember what they're called.
Explore cards.
Explore cards, right, you just said that. You shuffle them all together, and then you also shuffle the monster cards and add one of them to the deck of explore cards, and then mm-hmm. shuffle that. Then you take each set of score cards and you randomize them individually, and then you pick one from each set, and then shuffle them, and then place those in order on the four scoring slots. There's A, yeah. B, C, and D, and so each one has its own scorecard. Yes. Now, with sets, it is that there are a total of, 16 scorecards? Or is it 12?
16. There's four sets of four.
Right. And a single set will care about the same type of terrain or the same concept for scoring. So you won't have more than one scorecard that cares about a given type of terrain in a game.
So those different sets, one of them doesn't care about a terrain. I'll talk about that one last. But there's the villages set. which only cares about village terrain types, and only scores points based on clusters of village terrains. There is the forest terrain type set, which only cares about forests. There is the water and farmland scoring set, which only cares about water and farmland. Every card in that set cares about both of those types of terrain. And then the final set of scoring cards is the, I guess I'll call it the line, because that is the symbol that they've used to depict it, a diagonal line. But this this scoring card cares about how all of your terrains are arranged on your board. It doesn't matter like what terrain it has, it just cares about how they're arranged. So like, for example, there's one that wants you to arrange all of your terrain shapes in perfect squares. There's one that wants you to arrange all of your terrains in the bottom left corner of your map without leaving any holes. There's one that wants you to fill out columns and rows. And then there's one that wants you to leave holes, and you get points for every hole you have left in your various terrains that is blank and surrounded on all sides by another terrain.
Right. Each season, you'll be scoring two of these at a time. So right. At the end of the first season, you score A and B. Second is B and C, then C and D, and then D and A.
Mm-hmm. And the seasons are just spring, summer, fall, and winter. And so that means that after you've selected one scoring card from every set and then shuffled them and arranged them in front of the A, B, C, and D cards, each of those scoring cards will only be scored twice. Over the course of an entire game, the A card once at the beginning, then once at the end, and then B, C, and D come up periodically. B is in spring and summer, C is in summer and fall, D is in fall and winter. You mentioned the Explore deck. It has a number of cards inside it. There will be these ambush cards. And we'll explain how they work in a second. There's also ruin cards, which are cards that force the next shape you draw to be placed in specific places on your map. I'll get into a little bit more detail on that in a moment. And then there's the wild Riftlands card, which is just a single square that can be any terrain type when you draw it. But every other card other than ruins, wild rifts, and the ambush cards is a terrain exploring card. It will bear either one or two terrain types on it and one or two different shapes on it. If it has two terrain types, then there's only one shape you can draw. If it has two shapes, then there's only one terrain type you can draw.
Right.
So for example, I have the deck of explore cards in front of me right now, and I'm looking at one called Orchard. It has two terrain types. It has forest and it has farmlands. And then the shape it depicts is like a Tetris L block. So when this card is drawn, every player has to draw this L-shaped block anywhere where it can fit on their map, which is, again, an 11 by 11 grid with only a handful of spaces already filled in by mountains. So mountains already are filled in. So you can't overlap a mountain with this shape. So you put it anywhere it fits and anywhere it makes sense to you in order to score points. But after you draw the shape, then you have to choose one of those two terrains to fill it in with. So if there was, you know, a forest scoring card for that season that you wanted to get points from, you would maybe choose to fill it in with forest. Or maybe if you don't care about the forest scoring card because it's already happened twice, maybe instead you care about the farmland scoring card, so you fill it in with farmlands. It's up to you which terrain type you choose, and it's up to each player individually which terrain they're going with. So that means that from this first card, people's maps will start to look wildly different, even though everyone is drawing off of the same cards. An example of the other type of terrain card you might come across, here's one. It is called Great River. The only terrain you can use or you can draw with this card is water, so you can't do any other type of terrain when you draw it. One of the shapes is a sort of like a W shape.
W pentomino.
Made out of five squares, all connected to one another. And then the other option is a straight line of three squares. So you choose one of those two shapes to draw on your map. You know, maybe you have a quite a large area that you'd like to fill up. Maybe you have the one that you want to fill in the bottom left corner. So the W, you know, would work. It would connect the bottom left corner up. But maybe instead you have a very small area that you'd like to fill in with the three in a straight row. So you choose whichever shape suits you. This card, in addition to every other Explore card that has a choice between a smaller or a larger shape, the smaller shape gives you a coin, which at the end of every season, you score 1 point per coin, and that's cumulative for every season. So if you get a coin in spring, you'll score it at the end of spring, summer, fall, and winter. So that one coin is technically worth 4 points by the end of the game.
Right. Additionally, so you mentioned the mountains from before.
Yes.
There are, I believe, five on both sides of the map, and they are filled in spaces already. So cards like the one that cares about a complete square will consider that as a filled in space.
Mm-hmm.
And when you surround a mountain on all four orthogonal sides, you get a coin.
Yes. If we haven't mentioned before, this is a roll and write game, by the way. So everyone has like their own individual map. It's just a sheet of paper from a little notepad of maps that the game comes with. And you draw all these in with a pencil. At the bottom of the sheet, there's some boxes where you fill in the points you've earned at the end of every season. And then just above that is a row of coins. And every time you earn a coin, whether by filling in the shapes around a mountain or drawing a smaller shape from one of these Explore cards, you fill in one of those coins. That's what you count at the end of every season.
Yeah.
As bonus points. Okay.
And then there are also, like you said, six ruins on each side.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, when you draw ruins, you draw the next card in the Explore deck, and you have to place that shape on one of your ruins.
Yes.
Now, if you can't draw a shape for any reason, either because it doesn't fit or because like you drew a ruins and you drew another shape, but you've already covered all your ruins, then you draw a 1x1 square anywhere in the on the map of any terrain type.
Yeah. It should be noted that you can rotate or flip any of these shapes however you want to make it fit on your map. So, you know, if you can't do a forward facing L from that farmlands card I mentioned, you can flip it the other way if it would fit somewhere else or if that would be more convenient for you, or you can rotate it however you want. Also, it should be noted that the only case in that rule you just mentioned, there's one exception for not being able to place, and that is when it comes to ambush cards. Because ambush cards, if there's no room for the ambush shape, you have to fill in that one square with a monster terrain type.
Right. So ambushes.
Yes, there's four different ambush cards. Each one has its own unique shape, and each one has a rotational direction around the table. So whenever an ambush card is drawn from the Explore deck, you pass your map to the player as it's indicated on the ambush card, so either to your right or to your left, and then they get to draw the shape depicted on the ambush card anywhere they want on your map, wherever it would fit. And this is important because at the end of a season, every space adjacent to a monster terrain, which is the type of terrain that ambush cards make you draw, is worth -1 points against your total for that season.
Right.
So if you're handed someone else's map and during an ambush, you want to put the monster's shape where it would go, and it would be difficult to fill in the spaces and where it already has many of its spaces already open.
Right. Remember that that's per space and not per side. Meaning that if a single open space is touching multiple monsters, it's only worth -1 point.
Yes. So yeah, there's four of those monsters. Whenever you draw an ambush card during the Explore phase, it's removed from the game after everyone's finished drawing it, so it won't appear again. But at the end or at the beginning of every season, you add another monster to the Explore deck. So by the end of the game, all four monster cards will have been added to the Explore deck. But it's not guaranteed that you'll encounter any or all of them.
Right. On our first time we played, we only encountered one or two.
Yeah, we only encountered one in our very first playthrough, and it was in winter. There's barely any room to fit them, but when we could fit them, there was also barely any room or time to fill in their spaces. But the game is a much different game when you draw those early, and players have to balance negating those negative points, which, again, if you don't fill them in, they're sort of cumulative, and also earning points from other cards. Let's see. Is there anything else to mention about the gameplay?
So when I mentioned both sides of the map, they're actually different. One side has the mountains in a sort of symmetrical pattern.
Well, the ruins and the mountains are in a rotationally symmetrical arrangement.
Right.
So meaning, like, anyone who places a shape in the bottom left, they could have just the same put the shape in the top right. The only case in which this is different is when you're dealing with the Broken Road scoring card, which cares about filling in the bottom left. Any other set of scoring cards on this map, the top left and the bottom left and the top right, the top left and the bottom right, they're all the same since it's rotationally symmetrical.
Then the flip side has a cavern in the middle of the map.
Yes.
That takes about like four spaces vertically, I think.
Yeah, it takes up seven spaces in kind of an oddly shaped arrangement, but all clustered in the center of the map. The mountains in this map as well are not rotationally symmetrical. Neither are the ruins. So there is very much a choice being made where you place, whether you place a shape in the bottom left or the top right or the bottom right or the top left or what have you.
Right. But the caverns count as filled in spaces. So for something like the scoring card that wants a perfect square or the one that cares about completed rows and columns, it can actually be kind of beneficial.
Yes.
All right.
After every season, you scored the two cards, and then at the end of the game, after the fourth season, which is winter, the player with the most points wins.
I just wanted to mention one more thing, which is that for cards that care about a terrain being surrounded, the edges of the map also count as being surrounding that space.
Yes.
So the corners are surrounded already on two sides.
Right. So a monster that's been put up against the edge of the map isn't very effective because it's already had some of its spaces filled. I forgot there is one thing that we had to mention, and that is the time value
mechanic
in this game. So every season has a time number associated with it. Spring and summer, the number is 8. Fall is 7. Winter is 6. And then every explore card that has a shape and terrain to it has a time value. At the beginning of the game, it's spring, the time is 8, you draw a card, I've drawn farmland, that has a time value of 1. So after everyone draws that shape and fills it in with that terrain, then we check to make sure that the explore cards haven't totaled or surpassed the time value of the month. In this case, it's 1, which is less than 8, so we draw another explore card. And we keep doing this, drawing more explore cards and drawing those shapes into our kingdom until we've drawn a scorecard that sums the time value of the explore cards to equal or exceed the time value of the current month. So after you reach 8, that's the end of spring. You count your points, you go to fall, or you go to summer, you draw cards until you get 8. By the way, explore cards go back into the explore deck at the end of every season, and the explore deck gets shuffled again at the end of every season, so it's, you know, random whether you'll draw similar cards or new cards or whatever. But there is a chance that you draw the same card season after season. And then fall has 7 and winter has 6. So the fall and winter seasons go a little bit faster on average than the spring and summer seasons, which is important to note because if you are, and this will sort of be our segue into strategy, that if you are only focusing on the active seasons scoring cards every season of the game, then you technically have less opportunities to score the C and D cards, or rather the A and D cards and the C cards than you do the B card. Like, you have 16 turns or 16 time values worth of turns to score the B card, 14 to score the A card, 15 C, 14 D, or less, 13 D? Yeah, I think something like that. So, so you have less time in the moment to score those cards, but technically you have the entire game to try and score those cards. So it's sort of a balancing act between how much time you have to actually prepare to score a card versus how much time you have before you can no longer score it for the rest of the game.
Right.
So going into strategy, I think obviously at the beginning of the game, you can see all of the scoring cards and where they line up for each season. So it's important to just sort of examine them and evaluate which ones you think you can get the most points out of. And whether you need to plan for them in advance or whether you can like focus on the current scoring cards and just leave those for later. No matter what, it's ultimately comes down to what cards you draw. So like, even if you want to score points from the forest card, if you don't draw any explore cards that let you draw forest terrain, then that you're just not going to score any points. But keeping in mind, like, okay, I could try and score points from the village card, which is card A, but the forest card in card C has a lot of potential if I focus on it early. So maybe I draw a card that has a choice between drawing village terrain or forest terrain. I might choose forest terrain instead. Similarly, I think you should always keep in mind the line scoring card, the one that cares about how all of your territories are arranged, regardless of terrain type, just because that's that synergizes pretty much with every other type of scoring card. So if you're keeping it in mind, then you're double duty out of all of your actions. Whereas if you're not keeping it in mind, you're like leaving points on the table.
Yeah. I think so. For me, I'm not super good at this game, I'll say, but I feel like it's not always great to focus on A in round one.
Mm-hmm.
Just because like, I mean, B will be scored twice coming up. Obviously A will be scored twice eventually, but it's something where it's like you don't want to neglect the round because then you'll get less points. But spring is when you start. Spring is always just kind of tricky because you might probably not get many points at all. I feel like it's generally better to build up for the later rounds in spring.
Mm-hmm.
Especially I think D is the easiest one to get a ton of points for because you have the most time to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. And then C as well, you have a lot of time to prepare for.
Yeah, you could think of it like this. Like, you may think, like, with A, it technically has, like, 14 time period points worth of being active. But A is the one that's active for the longest because you have all 29 time points of the entire game to focus on that last chance to score A. But because of that, like, it's really hard in the first season to maximize a card's points. And I think if I could distill the strategy, the cards that give you the most points, you want to score them as high as you possibly can twice. Like, that's where you get a bunch of points. It's when you take a big number and you double it. You can't really do that with A because you can't get that big number on the first turn. You can only hope to get that big number on the last turn.
Right.
Whereas B, C, and D, it's very easy to get a really big number and then double it. Less so for A. So yeah, I think when you think of it, sort of like the game isn't about like racking up points every term. It's about getting like a really big number and then doubling it. Then it makes more sense to focus on B, C, and D, which are much easier to double.
Right. That being said, I think it's definitely worthwhile to go for coins in A and B, or in spring and summer, I mean.
Yeah.
Because coins are cumulative. They give you points every round. Getting a coin in spring means it's 4 points. Getting a coin in summer means it's 3.
Mm-hmm. One thing I enjoy about this game is that it's really easy to determine how many points any given placement of a shape is going to give you, at least immediately. You don't know how it's going to combine with other territories in the future, but in the moment, you can kind of rack it up. And one way of identifying how good a space might be, in addition to all the other scoring cards that may or may not be active, is just saying, like, if it gives you a coin, that coin is worth 1 point per season left in the game, including the current season. So yeah, in A and B, every coin you earn is worth 4 or 3 points, which is a pretty good number.
Yeah.
It's also a pretty good number for like one shape to give you.
Also, you could think of coins as canceling out one monster empty space, or one empty space adjacent to a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Which really helps you kind of figure out how many monster spaces you need to fill in versus how many shapes you can spend on scoring cards instead.
Mm-hmm.
As far as which ones are the easiest to score and max out, I think the obvious one is the line, because any shape can go towards it.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience,
the line is guaranteed one, because whatever shape you draw, it can always probably fit into whatever line scoring card is part of this game.
Yeah, in my experience, the villages aren't too hard to max out or get a lot of points. They tend to involve getting big clusters of villages, clusters being connected groups of village shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty easy to do, all things considered. Because a lot of the other ones for the forests and the water/farms rely on more specific placement, with things being like adjacent to other terrain types or things being surrounded. Having large clusters of villages doesn't have a lot of caveats. Probably the biggest one is either the one that requires the second biggest one to give you points, or the one that is villages that aren't connected to mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you still have a lot of room to play around with, and it's not hard to get, like, you know, upwards of 20 points in one round.
Mm-hmm. Greenbow, as far as forest scoring cards go, is one of the easiest to max out early on.
Which one is that?
Greenbow gives you 1 point for every column that has at least one forest tile in it, and every row for that has at least one forest.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've played with that one.
So that gives a maximum of 22 points, because it's an 11 by 11 grid that you're working with. And any given shape, you know, is essentially worth its value in height plus width, as long as it's not overlapping another shape's column or row. And it's really easy to find those spaces and fill them in. You can max out Greenbow with like only 11 squares of forest spaces. Compare that to like Shield Gate, which, if you want to get it scores 2 points for everything in the second largest village cluster. It takes, if you had 11 villages for that, that's a 6 and a 5, so it's only 10 points versus 22 for having 11 forests for Stonebow, perfectly, or Greenbow, perfectly arranged. So it's very efficient. Greenbow has a lower ceiling than some things. Like, technically, you could get way more than 22 points per turn with some of these cards, but I think Greenbow is probably the most efficient forest card, followed by maybe Stoneside Forest, which is about connecting your mountains with clusters of forests.
Right.
That's actually, Stoneside Forest depends on what side you're playing on, because on the symmetric side, it's easy to connect any two mountains with one shape. But on the asymmetric side, some of the mountains are pretty isolated from others. So it might take two shapes to reach them.
Yeah.
Let's see. We talked about forest, line, and village. That leaves the water and farmland ones, which I think are, there's some water and farmland ones are kind of easy to maximize. I think Mage's Valley, which wants you to put water and farmlands near mountains, and Golden Granary, which wants you to put waters and farmlands near ruins, are both deceptive because obviously, like, whichever one is more valuable, like, farmlands are more valuable on ruins, water is valuable around ruins, and for the other one, Mage's Valley, water is more valuable next to the mountains than farmlands are, but they're both worth points. The thing is, like, you're always drawing these shapes that involve more than one space, and so you can never, like, perfectly optimize these cards. Just the way that you put down a shape. If you want the farmland to be on the ruin, it's part of a shape that's going to cover up one of the adjacent spaces and score you no points. So you can't put a water in that space now.
There's one that is like, it gives you points for water and farms that aren't touching, right?
Yes, the one. So it's called Shoreside Expanse. It's like my least favorite scoring card, but it has the highest ceiling technically. If you're smart. And plan very far ahead for it. But it says you score 3 points for every cluster of water or farmlands that isn't adjacent to the edge of the board or adjacent to the other terrain. So you get 3 points for every farmland that's not adjacent to water and 3 points for every water that's not adjacent to farmland. And that's per cluster, not per space. So, you know, a shape of four water connected to each other is only worth 3 points as long as it's not touching either thing. If you can make the space for it and place your thing strategically, this one could lead to the highest ceiling of points. You know, you could have so many different clusters, each one scoring 3 points. But the downside is that it forces you to make a lot of holes, spread your pieces very far out.
It's good to pursue if you have the scoring card that wants holes.
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive against most of the line cards, except for cauldrons that wants the holes in your kingdom. So if you get Shoreside Expanse plus cauldrons, then it could be worth your time. But otherwise, it's a little unfortunate. All of these, by the way, again, have the caveat that you need to be drawing these cards from the Explore deck at random, these terrain types that you need. So when we give you these advice here, it's more like, consider when you draw a terrain card that has two different terrains on, which ones are you going to choose? You know, if you have Green Bough or if there's a good village card, then that'll determine which one of those you might go for.
Right. If you're in like the first turn of a scorecard and you're not drawing many cards that fit with it, it might be better to just focus on what the next scorecard will be instead to maximize points for a later session.
Now, that said, if you've drawn a lot of cards that don't have the terrain type you're looking for, it's more likely that you're about to draw a card that does, because there's a limited, I think there's just an even distribution of how much each terrain type is represented in the deck. So, you know, if you draw 5 non-water cards, the next card is most likely going to be water, just by the odds. The Explore deck is pretty small, too, so there's probably, you know, some like easy math one could do if they were to study this Explore deck closely. I have not, but I'm sure that the easy math would probably come out to like increases in like 10% chance of drawing a card.
Yeah.
I predicting the next card, by the way, brings me to my next point, which is after you play the game a number of times, which is really easy to do because the game is very quick to play. You'll start to get like a feel for the different shapes that are in this game that you will be drawing and how they all fit together. This is sort of like that sixth Tetris sense that you develop if you play a lot of Tetris, where you can just kind of like see the outline of your stack of shapes and understand like what shapes you need to get dealt to fill them in properly. So after you've played the game a couple times and you're getting a feel for all the shapes, it helps to arrange your shapes so that you have multiple outs in the deck for how you would finish, you know, different arrangements or accomplish different tasks. Like, I know that there is a card in the deck that is either forest or village, and it's like an S with an extra little length on one end. But then there's also like a T bar from Tetris, and there's a number of other shapes that could fill a similar. There's a small L that could be a forest. So knowing all of the different shapes in the deck lets you know that, okay, I can place this shape next to this shape in my kingdom because I know that there's like three other shapes that I could fill in here, and that will finish the square, or that will finish the bottom left corner, or what have you, whatever card you're shooting for. So both understanding that there's even distribution of terrain types, so you're more likely to draw a terrain type that hasn't been drawn yet, and understanding the shapes, you can help plan for multiple outs that way, which will make you a better player.
Yeah.
I think it's good to cover ruin holes early, unless you have the cauldrons, cover ruin spaces early, unless you have the cauldrons, just because once they're all covered and then another ruin card is drawn, it's actually pretty useful to have just that one square so that you can fill in a hole somewhere.
Right.
And you can fill it in with any terrain.
Yeah, realistically, you won't fill in the ruin. You won't fill in all of the ruin spaces until winter.
Yeah.
Unless you do this. And that's pretty much the time where, like, you're looking for one specific thing to fill in a space.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes beneficial to you if you only fill in one space by then, because it might give you exactly what you need to round out a scoring objective.
Yeah, one space could mean filling in a hole, and that could be like an extra 3 or so points from the line card. It could mean having the correct type of terrain adjacent to another type. It could mean expanding a cluster to be just one larger. So like your second largest village could be then tied with your largest village and score, you know, that much more points from the village card. There's so many versatile uses. Or it could just fill in a really pesky, hard to fill in space next to a monster or next to a mountain. So there's a lot of things that just a single space can do. And oftentimes I am more happy to draw that in than to cover up a ruin with a larger shape. Let's see.
As far as monsters also, go.
I wanted to mention right before we talk about placing your opponent's monsters is that if you can't really make points out of a shape, sometimes it helps just to throw it in the middle of nowhere where you have a really big open area, just so that it's harder for your opponents to place monsters on your board. Now monster shapes.
Yeah. I'm not usually very good at filling in these. It seems like a good idea is to focus on having one size holes created by the monster, because those are the hardest to fill.
Yeah, I like to put them like near, you know, the mountains or near the chasm in the center of the map if you're playing with the backside, or just somewhere very close to other shapes but not touching them. Leaving those very small, awkward holes around them, just because those are the hardest to fill in. And the goal of the monster is to score the most negative points for your opponent if, you know, you're trying to play very competitively and optimally. I have played games where person gets the monster card and they just kind of put it wherever, or they put it in an amusing place rather than the most damning place for the opponent.
I think if the line card is like Broken Road or the square one, it might be worthwhile to put the monster just all the way on the other side. That way the player has to weigh either putting points towards their other card or just taking a ton of monster negatives.
Yeah. Unless the monster creates so many awkward spaces that it'll be hard for that player to fill in those spaces and finish like the Broken Road or what is it called? The Lost Barony. Then yeah, it helps just play away and force that player to make a hard decision. Okay. So I don't have any more strategy tips for this game.
Right. I think like that's about it.
Covers it. Let's talk about the design, but before that, let's do a quick plugs section. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast, where you can hit us up with suggestions for episodes or just let us know that you're a fan, because we really enjoy hearing that. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged, so you can find specific episodes where we talk about specific games that you're interested in hearing our thoughts on. And you can find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/BGPcast, where we sell our merch. Let's go to Matt Plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on most weeks on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. from around 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I have been playing a lot of Hitman 3, which I just finished my first playthrough, and now I am going through the first two games in the Hitman reboot trilogy. I also play a lot of fighting games, platformers, roguelites, what have you. I make YouTube videos at youtube.com/IEatAtSonic. That's IEatAtSonic. I make video essays on video games. And then also you can find my other podcast at NetSurfer Pro on all podcasting platforms, or at NetSurfer Pro on Facebook and Twitter. And it is a podcast where me and a friend of mine talk about a lot of sort of modern day interesting media. We've done episodes on the Santa Claus trilogy with Tim Allen, the album Since I Left You, the mashup album series Mouth Dreams, Mouth Silence, all that. And this month we've been doing episodes on Flash games because it's the end of Flash. So if you're interested in more media analysis of a greater variety, check that out.
Mm-hmm. And you can follow each of us individually on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming for Matt and at Jeff Craig Designs for me.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the design of cartographers a little bit here.
Okay.
Let's see. So I enjoy that the game, it tickles me that the game lists itself as being playable by 1 to 100 players, because extra players in this game do not have any bearing on how much time it takes to play. It's a roll and write game, so of sorts. Technically, you don't roll, you draw from a deck, but it's another method of randomization. And draw game. Any interaction or anything that would have any bearing on what someone else did is only ever between two players. So adding more players doesn't change that. It's cool that any number of people can play it. It's incredibly fast to set up and very play. So there's a lot of replayability. I mean, the game has a lot of replayability built into it just by how you like shuffle the cards and deal them out in different ways. It makes different strategies and different prioritizations of different shapes and terrains more viable from game to game. So it just leads to playing this game a whole lot. And every time I've played it, I've had a great time. The main thing that I want to bring up is the satisfaction that the game gives me, but I'll let you finish your thought.
Right. I was going to say it has all the typical roll and write benefits of like, you can play it online. You can play it by correspondency, kind of like correspondent chess. But, you know, you could just be like, these are the cards I drew in this order. Now you try.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of options to play it. And like you said, there's solitaire, of course, which means that it has a lot of possibilities for when you can play it, which is especially great in our current circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You can even print out one of the maps so that you can play it with another person over the internet.
Sure. I'm sure Jordy Aiden or Thunderworks Games would not have any problems with you getting other people to print out these maps to play it virtually. Although I don't want to speak for them necessarily, but I would just assume. I want to talk about how satisfying it is to put the shapes together in this game. This is like probably my favorite part about it, and something that I guess some other board games try to have, like Tiny Towns tries to has it, but since I do have almost ultimate control of how everything goes in my map, it's just so incredibly satisfying, you know, to draw a shape and leave a blank space and then to draw the shape that fills it later on in the game. I'm also sort of a perfectionist with the appearance of the lines that I draw on my kingdom and the symbols that I draw in them. So it all just ends up being very satisfying for me.
You can definitely tell he's that many a graphic designer.
Aren't. Yes. Many games don't have this level or this breed of satisfaction. It scratches a unique itch. Which is one thing that's going for this game.
Right. Filling in the map is pretty thematic. It's definitely fitting that, like, as you play the game more and explore more, you're slowly mapping in more of the terrain. Mm-hmm. And what's kind of neat is that the line cards kind of add to the theme, because it's like you start in one area and you tend to branch out so that you can make these, like, more solid shapes. Because, you know, it's easier to just play off what you have than it is to, like, plan ahead very far away. But that's mm-hmm. fitting, because if you were to explore a kingdom, you would start in one area and then expand from there. But yeah, like, even for me, who's not very good at drawing or making lines, it's very satisfying to fill things in.
I mean, you do play a lot of Tetris, don't you?
Oh, yeah. It has that same itch of, like, you build a shape and then you know what shape goes there, and then you fit it in, and it just makes a solid grouping.
This isn't quite the intense mental barrage that Tetris gives you, where, like, after you've played it for an hour, you, like, start to see Tetris shapes forming together in your mind. But it's similar. It's sort of like the nicotine patch for Tetris syndrome.
Tetris effect, excuse
me. Tetris effect, yes. It's sorry, funny, they trademarked that. I can't say it anymore.
It's funny because it reminds me of another game based off Tetris pieces, which is the Uwe Rosenberg season series, mm-hmm. which I guess is four games. But those are also seasonal based, which I just think that's funny. There's no sort of greater commentary from that.
Mm-hmm. I like that this game's theme is it probably lends itself to being one of the most immersive games ever made just on paper, because you know, if you're just looking at my board game shelf, if you're an architect or a running some other kind of kingdom, if you're a witch, your job doesn't probably involve on a day-to-day like moving a pawn on a piece of cardboard, but or exchanging little wooden cubes. But if you're a cartographer, your job is literally drawing shapes on a piece of paper.
Right. There is.
And so physically, this game is the most immersive game ever made, because you are literally doing exactly what you would have been doing if you were an actual cartographer. I think it's one of the, like, I think this is on paper, though. You don't actually get that feeling when you play the game.
Right.
But
it is kind of paper, weird, because, like, you're putting the shapes wherever you want. So true. It's less like you're discovering a terrain and more like you're building the terrain.
Yeah, there is a slight like hitch right there in between, like, finding the terrain and mapping it down. You kind of have to, like, rewrite your memory in a way, like, lie to yourself, like, oh, I'm drawing it there because it was there the whole time.
Yeah.
Although I think the Riftlands card might sort of make some sort of assumption that the world itself is magical and changing. That said, every player is mapping their own individual kingdom, at the end of which you do get to name and draw the coat of arms if you'd like. And so that at least gives an example as to why, like, every player is making something different.
Yeah, there's some really fun personalization there. It's another thing it reminds me of is Between Two Castles, where you name your castle at the end. Right. I love these sort of, like, personalized scoring sheets in games, just because it's really fun for me to just add a little capstone at the end to look back on whatever just happened and be like, what name can I come up with that fits my experience? And why is half the time it's something like Garbage Land, or There's Too Many Holes Here?
Or Lots of Trees.
Lots of Trees. Tree Town.
Let's see. Go ahead.
Here. Yeah, so I think the player interaction in this game is really interesting with the monsters. So, like, from what I understand, a lot of Roland Rites, their main source of differentiation between players, which is, like, what makes player scoring different, mm-hmm. is that there's all these small decisions, and each player has the freedom to make those however they want. You know, it's very unlikely that any two players will do the exact same placement unless they look at each other's board. But Cartographers has the monsters, where not only do they take not only is it like another small decision that has cascading effects, but it's on another player's map. So it's one player's decision that is based off another player's decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of puts the game through another filter, sort of differentiation. So that, you know, now it's not just the effects of one person or the decisions of one person, but it's the decisions of two people. And the fact that the monsters are the opposite of pretty much anything that the regular shapes want to do means that it has very different sort of approaches for each person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, monsters, they're really cool to me because they use the exact same mechanics as every other part of the game. That is just filling in shapes and marking them in with a shape or a symbol. But like they use those in a completely different context because instead of trying to fit a shape or a scoring method, you're trying to stop them. And so it really makes you kind of think about where to place them really heavily, maybe even more so than you would some of the regular shapes, because they have such different effects. But since you can play them anywhere, it's like it still adds a huge amount of agency to it. And it really makes you feel like you're impacting the other players.
It's also cool on the same topic of like making sure that, not really making sure, but having so many choices that players will inevitably deviate from each other's game plans, is that the input of this game is variable. Versus like compared to a roll and write game with dice, where like if you roll a side of a die and you get a 4, everyone has to use that 4. But in this game, you draw a card and the card still gives you choices. So you could choose whether you do forest or village. You could choose whether you do a small shape or a big shape. And different players will come to their own conclusions with how they use those cards. Add that onto like the various features of a map. If you're playing on the reverse side with everything being asymmetric, then it's even more important to where you choose to put something. It ends up leading to games that deviate within the first season from pretty much everybody.
Yeah. I like that the monsters encourage the player who's placing them to think of like really devious places to place them and like think of weaknesses, structural weaknesses, because when you get that ability and that power to poke at somebody else's weaknesses, it makes you start to think about how you can play better as well. Like the fact that you are being aggressive at the same time as being attacked gives you the experience on both ends.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. Like you never feel like you're getting screwed over or you're the one doing the screwing over, because it's just happening simultaneously to everyone.
Right. And then also one thing that I think is a little understated, but I really want to bring up, is that other players draw monsters on your map. So like, you know, throughout the game, you are adding your own terrain types on your map. So you'll draw trees, you'll draw villages, whatever. But the monsters on your map will be from other players, meaning they're in other art styles or other drawing types. Ooh, and it for one thing, it sort of reinforces the theme of like monsters coming from other lands to sort of raid your kingdom.
Getting itches.
Oh, no. But also,
I hate the idea. Other people ruining my art.
I know. At least, look, you redraw our lines all the time. That's the compromise.
I don't even ask. I just erase everyone's
I've
monster
stopped
lines.
Drawing lines. I just draw evil faces.
I draw them in the same place, obviously, but draw them much neater.
Right. But it also means there's a little bit of the other players just as like a memorable token, sort of.
Yeah, it is very cool.
Yeah, in the same way that you look at your own kingdom you've made to make a name, you'll look over it and see the other player's impact.
Yeah, it's jarring. It's glaring. It's very easy to spot because it's in a different handwriting, basically. Unless it's my map, in which I'll redraw it to match everything else, because I'm just like that. But yeah, it is a very cool just extra element of texture to this game that adds to the theme, and is just a natural result of the mechanics of the game.
Yeah, it doesn't add too many more verbs.
So I have played this game a whole lot, and I continue to want to play it. So I think that this game is insanely replayable with just the pieces that you get, as sparse as they are in the main game. Like, there's so few cards in this game, and yet there's so many different combination and ways the game can play out that it's always an interesting challenge to tackle every time we play. That said, I have kickstarted or backed or purchased after the Kickstarter wrapped up multiple expansion materials for this game, and I'm eagerly awaiting them, I think in June of 2021, for them to be delivered, because I'm very interested to see, like, all the different extra spaces this place can go. First and foremost, the variety of maps that can appear in this game. And then also, like, other ways to deal with monsters, or just new monster shapes, new other shapes to add to the explore deck. I'm just very interested to see where this game will go, despite it being so replayable, just because, like, I'm just excited to see even more variants to the game and play it even more. That might be one way of endorsing a game, is to say, like, I love it. I can't wait to get more expansions.
Yeah.
I want more of it. The last point I have is that Shoreside expansion sucks. Oh, and also the art and the graphic design is also excellent. Right. Very well done.
It uses symbols for every color. So,
yeah,
you know, that's a pretty standard.
The symbols are well decided, because these are symbols that characters will have to, or players will have to replicate. So, you know, hash marks versus wavy horizontal lines versus circles and sticks versus houses. Also, I mean, I don't think it's actually mentioned anywhere in the game, but, you know, it, as long as the player understands what shape they're drawing, you can change it however you want. Like, I mean, the farmland is made with six hash marks. Whatever, you can do it in three, you can do it in two, and you can still understand. You could even do it in one. Just put a diagonal line across your square. You know that's a farmland. Draw the house however you like. Draw the monsters. Right off the bat, everyone I've played this game with draws monsters differently, which is very amusing.
Yeah.
So I like all that, that the game's mechanics were decided on, and to a point where they're recognizable, customizable, personalizable. Is that a word?
Sure.
Yeah. So that's, it was very smart to choose the shapes that they did for the different terrain types, and yeah, the art looks good. Design is clear, pretty for the most part. I think the one ding it gets visual design wise is just the scoring cards, because sometimes it takes a couple read throughs of the description to know exactly how they work.
Yeah, but once you learn them, it goes very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. You become very familiar with this game because you play it so much, like I have. Do you have any more points to make about the game?
Nope.
All right, then that will be the conclusion on our episode on Cartographers. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
And I guess we'll see you next week, when hopefully we eventually do get a chance to play Architects, and then we can give you our full unadulterated thoughts on that game.
Yeah. See ya.
See ya.